The financial world analyzes and evaluates the economic crisis with graphs, charts. According to all of these graphs, they prove the obvious. That there is less abundance in this land, more unemployed in this land. According to their charts, the real rate of growth of the gross national project, gross national product has in fact fallen and not risen. According to their charts, the cost of consumer goods has gone up some 15% in the last 12 months. The real disposable income of Americans has dropped. We've had a serious imbalance, serious deficit in our trade balance, which is to say that something of the American standard of living is being sent abroad. And the rate of unemployment has risen from some 4.5% to some 6.5% of the working force. Now, I confess that a rabbi does not judge the economic crisis in terms of graphs and charts. I have a much more rudimentary, much more personal way of looking at the economics. I look at people. And for me, the figures that indicate that the rate of unemployment has risen from 4.5% to 6.5% in 12 months translate immediately to numbers, to people. This 2% rise in the rate of unemployment, which is simply a percentage, translates into nearly 2 million people. 2 million people who either do not have work or are entering the workforce and cannot find work, or who have been dismissed from their work, or who are unemployable. 2 million people more than a year ago who are subsisting on public welfare and the federal food stamps program and various forms of unemployment compensation. I really didn't need the graph to indicate to me some 3 years ago that inflation had begun to move to a level of serious concern. The welfare workers of Cleveland began to report that a few here and a few there were coming into the welfare center saying that they could not make ends meet. They needed food for their tables. The cost of rent was going up. Utility bills had increased. The cost of basic clothing items had increased. Food was on its way up. And what with a combination of various forms of support, they still couldn't make the dollar stretch to meet all of their basic needs. Some 2.5 years ago, the religious community of Cleveland helped to establish 8 hunger centers, 4 on the west side, 4 on the east side, where people could come and be given a certain kind of supplemental subsistence. And these hunger centers represented for me the facts of the economic crisis. For people came first by ones and twos and tens, and soon they were coming in tens and twenties and fifties. The number rose week after week. And I could see through the rather optimistic untruths of the Nixon administration when they told us that inflation was abating, that the economic condition was in hand, because the numbers who came increased week after week, month after month, whatever the pronouncements were coming out of Washington. And I remember during those months having a long conversation with a businessman who was part of an industry which had just petitioned Washington for certain kinds of restrictive tariffs against foreign competition, who was complaining bitterly against these hunger centers. We were coddling the poor. We're making it too easy for them not to work. People shouldn't turn to the government for the solution to their economic problems. Self-reliance, work, these were the ways. And I asked him if he remembered reading in the newspapers the poverty diet, which had been published some months before. You may recall these diets. They were attempts by the nutritionists who worked for the newspapers to go out and to purchase in the public supermarkets sufficient nutrient values for a family of four, given the value of the food stamps and the public assistance which a poor family could be expected to spend. And what these experts discovered was that not only couldn't you afford luxuries, you couldn't afford fresh vegetables, you couldn't afford fresh fruit, and you could afford only the lowest grade of meat, and then only twice a week. The basic diet was one of grains and flour and soy and beans and potatoes, starches. Beyond that, you scrimped, you saved, and you hoped to put enough caloric and nutrient value on the table. One of the unseen charts, because I haven't seen it published anywhere, is a variation of the chart that you've all seen. The increased cost of the food basket. You know that when you go to the grocery store, it costs you more. And according to the statistics, the cost of an average basket of food for your table and mine has increased some 32% in the last 24 months. But no one has charted the increased cost of these basic staples which the poor must buy. And interestingly, when you look for these figures, you discover that the cost of food to the poor has increased 38%. These are precisely the foods which have had the most dramatic increase. In the Talmud, we have a saying, "Bata anya, ba'azla anyuta," that poverty pursues the poor. And that's true in America today. The cost of clothing has gone up. The cost of work clothes has gone up more than the cost of dress clothes. The cost of housing has gone up. The cost of basic housing has gone up more than the cost of luxury rentals. Poverty, unfortunately, pursues the poor. Now, if we were to believe our national magazine, everyone is suffering from this economic crisis. But somehow the suffering of the rich is not the suffering of the poor. Yes, the rich suffer, but they must be told by an accountant just how much they're suffering. They're suffering paper losses. And there's no indication that they are in any way reducing their standard of living, though there are many indications that they're reducing their standard of giving. The same issue of the Wall Street Journal had two articles on Wednesday or Thursday of this last week. The lead article spoke of the fall-off in giving to charitable agencies at this Christmas time. And inside there was a list of the production of automobiles in December of this year compared to December of 1973. And I was not surprised to read there that the production and sales of automobiles in every category was significantly lower this year than last year, save one. The sale of Cadillac cars was up 18% over a year before. The airlines tell me that the southbound planes are crowded to capacity. The rich suffer. I'd like to suffer with them. The middle class has suffered a loss in purchasing power. People have delayed moving from older homes into newer homes. Mothers are buying less expensive cuts of meat and less delicacies in the market. It's more concerned with quality, food. children are coming home to go to college rather than paying the dormitory fees. And the poor are suffering physically. They're hungry, some of them. Many are shivering during this cold winter. They don't have the clothes against the winter, and they can't pay the utility bills. And all of them are spending an unconscionable amount of time shifting from here to there in one line or another. Food stamps, for employment, for unemployment insurance, for public welfare. Now, I confess that I understand why the financial world must quantify and chart economic trends. You've got to understand the dimensions of a problem before you can begin to deal with them. But I am suspicious that many of those who quantify and use the computer and develop these charts see only the charts and not the human emotions, the suffering which the charts represent. When America first began to endure what they call double-digit inflation, Game Plan was introduced by the Nixon administration, which had to do with dampening down the demand side of the economy. There was too much money seeking out goods. And so there was to be a policy of tight money, heightened interest rates. There was to be a reduction of the federal budget and the like. And one of the inevitable consequences of these such programs is an increase in the rate of unemployment. Less goods are produced because there's less market for goods, therefore less people are employed. And 18 months ago or so, I was reading article after article by this learned Secretary of the Treasury or that learned University of Chicago economist telling me that a 6 or 6.5% rate of unemployment was an acceptable cost for solving the problems of inflation. And I kept asking myself, acceptable to whom? Acceptable to a public servant who is being very well paid,
many of whom are protected by civil service contracts. Acceptable to a tenured university professor who's guaranteed a biweekly paycheck. Or acceptable to the 2 million people who receive their pink slips, who are out of work, and who, even if they're getting unemployment compensation, will receive that compensation for only 26 weeks or 39 weeks. And that compensation does not begin to give them the full wage that they were earning before they were shown the door. You know, it's an interesting fact about our country, about our policies these last months, years, is that we have tried to make the weakest and the poorest pay the cost of solving our economic problems. I haven't seen one of those captains of industry with often almost obscene salaries offering to cut his salary in half by two-thirds in order to keep X number of people in his plant on the payroll. I haven't seen the well-organized unions being unwilling to strike, even though this throws more people out of work for very high increases in wages, showing concern for the rest of the workforce as much as they're showing concern for their own folk. I haven't seen the federal government be willing to take the initiative to tell the American people that the belt must be tightened and to see to it that the belt is tightened at all levels and not just on those who are thrown out of work. There was a great debate some months ago as to whether or not this country was also in a recession. About the inflation, there was no doubt. But the economist argued this way or that, that you needed so many quarters during which the gross national product fell before you could declare that this was a recession, or that you needed a certain fall in the real level of productivity. Whatever the argument, a rabbi did not need the charts. He had only to look at the hunger centers. And he'd only to see a new kind of client at these centers. Now, originally, we found there the unemployables, the approximately 3 million Americans who simply can't be fitted into the workforce. But now we began to find young people who just left school, for whom there were no jobs. People who had used up their 26 weeks of unemployment compensation. A new kind of client was there. And beyond this, we began to recognize that America had not begun to pay the price of recession as yet, because since the New Deal and the Fair Deal, we've had various protective devices to cushion the shock of a downturn in the economic cycle. But most of these cushions are time-limited. It's estimated that 3 million of the 6 million unemployed today are receiving unemployment compensation. That unemployment compensation will run for half a year. What then? What will happen next May, June, July, August, when these funds are no longer available to those who were released from their work in October, November, December of this year? We're in a recession, we're in inflation, the economy has turned down. About 3 weeks ago, the county commissioners of Cleveland summoned the religious community and other segments of the community to a meeting in which they told us, in effect, that they lacked the funds to deal with a new level of public welfare assistance required. They asked us, the religious community, to increase greatly the level of support available at the hunger centers. We have and we will. To feed the poor is obviously one of the basic obligations of religious men. But at the same time, this kind of voluntary soup kitchen or bread line is no answer to the structural and to the basic problems of our economy. The richest country on earth failed during the richest period in our history to set up a broad-based system of public assistance which would have seen to it that enough was banked during the fat years to take care of the lean years. Perhaps it's not a coincidence that this week in our synagogues we read of the dream of Pharaoh when he saw seven fat cattle grazing on the banks of the Nile, and suddenly seven lean kine come out of the Nile and consume the seven fat cattle. Joseph, you'll recall, interpreted that dream to mean that there would be 7 great years of harvest for Egypt and then 7 years of blight. And Pharaoh and Joseph, you'll recall, organized storehouses into which the excess, the surplus of the rich years was put against the lean years. America did very little during the 25 fat years that we enjoyed. We put very little money away. We lived to the hilt and then some. That was the American way. And now we're asking the poor to pay the price of our own greed. I was troubled a good bit by those meetings with the county commissioners, troubled in many ways. I was troubled by the fact that the very week that the county commissioners sounded the alarm about poverty, they lacked the funds to feed the poor, they found ways of going out into the money markets and indebting the city of Cleveland for $30 million in order to add to the completion of our Justice Center. Just the interest on this extra $30 million, some $3 million of dollars, would pay the needed food bill for the hungry of Cuyahoga County many times over. Seems to me that we still want our cake and to eat it too. There's still a confusion of priorities between bricks and between people. I was troubled also by a report that was released the same week as we were told by the commissioners they didn't have the money to feed the poor, which indicated that during the first full year of revenue sharing between the federal government and the states and local governments, of the monies which had been released by Washington, only 2% had found their way into welfare uses, into welfare assistance. 98 cents on every dollar which had been released by Washington was used for other purposes. Again, this strange concern for things, for the luxuries, for the niceties, as against need, desperation, people. I was concerned that sitting in that same room with the commissioners on the commission which had been appointed were leaders of business and leaders of industry who had been the very same folk who the week before and a month before had released the workers who were now applying for assistance. And I wondered about an economy which allows industry to use people and then toss them aside at a moment's notice and assume that the population as a whole must pay the social and human cost of their lack of human concern. I understand a businessman's concern with profit. I understand a businessman's concern with his stockholders' investment, but I would submit to you that there must be an equal concern, at least, with the well-being of those who have given hours and days and months and years to a factory, corporation, or an industry. I'm concerned in many ways as a rabbi by this American way, which looks to profits rather than to people, which has looked upon work as if it were something that was not to be demanded of us. We didn't work unless we derived pleasure from our work. And one of the things that as a rabbi this whole economic crisis says to me is that America had better shake itself loose of this hedonism, materialism, this love of pleasure which has been so systemic in our nation throughout the last years. All of us have heard the captains of industry and the ordinary store owners complain about the absenteeism of the workforce, about their lack of concern with the quality of their work, about their indifference to quality, their indifference to the corporation itself. I remember being told some years ago I should never buy a car that had been produced on a Monday or a Friday because these were days when the work was even more slipshod than it normally was. I didn't hear as often these last months complaints about the industrialists themselves, but I keep seeing them having three-hour alcoholic lunches. And I know that as I go to the airport, there are any number of very expensive jet planes there for their private travel, and that they talk of hunting lodges and vacations and vacations and vacations again. And I suspect that it is not simply the workforce that has been indifferent to quality, to work, but everyone. Not everyone, but most who are out there in industry. And that the non-competitiveness of American goods, their lack of quality, their high cost per unit cost is due in large measure to this terrible indulgence which Americans have accepted as a way of life. Why work if we don't have to work? Let's not do any work which we don't, which we are not satisfied by. Let's not be too concerned by the product that we produce. What is of concern is the fast buck and how fast we can spend it. And somehow or other, there is no way out of this economic crisis. No program which can be devised by government or by anyone else, which will not require a much higher degree of sacrifice for work on the part of all Americans. We'll have to produce goods of quality. We'll have to increase efficiency. The efficiency of our working force has been decreasing, not increasing. We'll have to understand that one works to produce, whether one is on the workforce, or a blue-collar worker, or a captain of industry. And then it seems to me that, as a rabbi, again, that we're not going to solve the problems of this economic crisis unless we develop a program in the near term which will provide for the basic needs of people, and in the long term we'll see to it that never again in this country will there cease to be a floor below which people can fall. There's no excuse for the other America, for its hunger, its lack of medical care, its lack of education, its lack of the basic decencies. It exists because rich America has turned its back on a negative income tax or a guaranteed annual wage or some other broad-scale program which would see to it that the basic needs are provided to all. And the time is long since past when we can allow the indulgence, the fatness, to exist side by side with desperation, hunger. That's the way to revolution. That's the way to social disorganization and ultimately the way to the loss of all of our freedoms. I've not even begun to allude to the shadow which hangs over the economy, not of our making, the shadow of the cost of energy, oil, the fact that some $3 billion this year and in this quarter and more next and more than next will leave this country for the Arab world and Iran and Venezuela, our standard of living going to others. Now, I would not complain about the cost of oil if, in fact, it were simply a case of the super rich in America losing something of their standard of living to the super poor of the Middle East, of South America. But unfortunately, the countries which have the most oil seem not to have the ability or the will to use that oil income for the benefit of their own citizenry or those who are their brothers and comrades. And what we have now is the building up of vast fiscal reserves in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Abu Dhabi and these other little places on the map. $65 billion, which are not constructively invested. $65 billion this year, $140 billion next year, $210 billion the next. Money sufficient to ruin, the states want to do so, the very fragile and complicated economic market which exists in the so-called free world. I have no solution to these problems. I would suspect that one of the solutions would be a massive cutback in our use of oil, but no one wants to take this unpopular step. We prefer to fall more and more into the hands of those whose power can destroy us. Instead of limiting our use of foreign oil, that use is on the increase. Instead of paying the cost to find new sources of energy in our own country, Project Independence, so announced a year ago with so much éclat, is ground to a complete halt. We seem to be determined plunge ahead to pay later, to enjoy prosperity now as much as we can without a concern for the cost of that prosperity for our children, for our grandchildren. In the Midrash, there's the phrase that Ein dor vador she'enu notel ukiya mimaaseh ha'egel. But there is no generation which is not in some way guilty of the crime of the golden calf. You'll recall that when Moses went up to Mount Sinai, when the sense of purpose in the nation had temporarily deserted it, the people built a golden calf and began to worship it. They danced before the gold. Their greed was in their eyes, the most primitive greed of man. And I'm afraid that greed is in our eyes again, that we are suffering the sin of the golden calf. Everybody should sacrifice but us. Everybody's standards of living can fall but ours. We want to hold on to the abundance and to the fatness and to the good things, in quotation marks, which have been ours, but can be. The Office of Economic Planning and Development, a prestigious international group, released this week a set of predictions for Western economies, the United States in particular, for 1975. Their predictions were all bleak. They said, in effect, that we can expect the rate of unemployment to rise to 8%. And privately, those who released the report said it was more likely that the rate of unemployment might rise to 10 or 12%. They said that every major indicator of economic productivity in the United States would fall. They said that we could expect the continuation of double-digit inflation. They said that the West would have to take vigorous action to deal with the oil-induced financial crisis. But where is that vigorous action? Unfortunately, the present administration has taken minimal action, and such action as it has taken has been the action of the Chartist rather than of the humanist. One of the ways to dampen inflation is to cut the federal budget. When Mr. Ford assumed office, he promised a cut in the federal budget of some $5 or $6 billion. What are his plans? Will he cut someone's favorite pork barrel project? A new federal office building here, a new base there, a new road in another place? Oh, no. His plan is to increase the cost of food stamps to the poor by 20%. His plan is to increase the costs borne by patients under Medicare and Medicaid far above the level that they now pay. His plan is to cut certain Social Security benefits for those who have not yet reached 65. And his plan is to reduce, if not to eliminate, the education benefits available to veterans of the Vietnamese War. In every case, the president has opted to make the poor pay, to make the least advantaged, least fortunate in the society, pay the cost for continued abundance, or at least continued well-being for the more fortunate segment of the society. Now, obviously, Mr. Ford will not be able to hold to this game plan. A Congress has been elected by another party with other points of view. And he's already had to accept a $5 billion program to provide unemployment compensation to those not covered by the major unions, to farm workers, to domestics, to state and local government people, to provide $1 billion for federal work projects, much like the WPA of the Depression years, to try and combat the recession. But he obviously doesn't want anyone to have to pay a high cost. They're talking now of no restrictions on the import of Arab oil. They're talking now of a minimal increase in the gasoline tax. They're talking now of pumping major amounts of money into the economy in order to stimulate demand, even though they know that in the long term, someone will have to pay that debt, and that someone will be the younger and the next generation. What's for it, then? I wish I knew. I'm not a prophet. I wasn't one of those called in by President Ford to give him advice. He called in the Chartists. He called in the economists. He called in government officials. He didn't call in the poor. He didn't call in the welfare rights groups. He didn't call in the religious groups who have tried to provide some aid against hunger these last years. And I'm a little bit afraid that the game plan that will emerge will again lean most heavily against the disadvantaged. It's time, I think, that our national leadership challenged America to find some other dream but two cars in every garage. I think it's time that someone in the administration in high place challenged America to be something more than a growth-oriented nation, producing things. Isn't it time that we produced values, values of community, human values? Isn't it time that we were proud of America not because of our great prosperity, but because of the quality of life available for all of our citizens? And one does not measure the quality of life by the amount of goods that one has. In Europe, they force feed certain kinds of geese in order to slaughter them, not to make them happier. But I don't hear anyone saying to America, look, you have so much. Begin to think again about your values. Begin to think about hedonism. Begin to think about materialism. Begin to think about the words that you profess in your churches and your manifestos and your civic concerns. Begin to be concerned about quality, about work, about saving, about preparing yourself for a time when we do not consume 40% of the fat of the earth. I am convinced that America will never again see the kind of prosperity which we have enjoyed over the last 25 years. And I question the very verb that I used, enjoyed. I don't believe that this prosperity has made us the happier. The rate of suicide went up throughout the age of abundance. The rate of mental breakdown went up throughout the age of abundance. The rate of divorce went up throughout this era of abundance. The rate of alcoholism went up throughout this era of abundance. The rate of addiction to dope went up throughout this era of abundance. None of the indices of happiness that you might expect are there. Only tension and anxiety in an America which gobbles down an endless supply of pills. We need to look at ourselves carefully and to ask, who is the happy man? And do I need this much money and this much of a trust fund for my children and this large a house and this expensive a car? And am I doing my share in through my effort and my sweat and my skills to increase the meaningful output of the American society? It seems to me that the answer to our economic crisis is not purely fiscal. The lawmakers and the economists will come up with this or that arrangement of has to do with interest rates, the amount of money to be unleashed in the economy, and what kind of stimulus must be given to business, and what kind of tax relief must be given to the to the poor and what kind of tax reform is required of the rich. That I expect of government. But I also expect of us and of our government a concern with principle, a hard look at oneself, because in a very real sense, as a rabbi sees this economic crisis, it's a crisis of people. We are the cause of this crisis.
And we are its solution. Amen.